Another beautiful spring day. So I'd like to tell you some. Is it going? Yeah. I'd like to tell you some stories about white rabbits. I am a few weeks late, and the Easter bunny is long gone. But somehow, a number of stimuli have led me to wanting to talk about white rabbits. Now, about a month ago, a white rabbit actually appeared to me. Michael and I were in Calgary, leading a retreat for the Soto Zen group there. And it was in a retreat center that was a Catholic convent run by an order of nuns. Beautiful spot on the Elbow River, right near downtown Calgary, but it was this enclave of quiet. And it looked out over the river and some parkland. So in the middle of the night, I got up, our room looked out over the river. In the middle of the night, I got up and looked out the window, and it was just like now, a few days short of a full moon. So there was this sort of hazy moonlight, and I saw something that at first looked like an odd-shaped, medium-sized white dog. And then I realized it was a really big white rabbit. And thinking back, it feels a little surreal. Did I really see that big white rabbit out there? I think so. And then 2 weeks ago, we had a women's retreat out at Blue Mountain Zendo, which is our house in the countryside outside Mission. And this Japanese curtain, it's called a noren. Often they hang in the entryways to traditional shops. This was hanging in the doorway of our laundry room. And Megan noticed it and asked me, what's the significance? Hey, there's another image in our house of the moon and a white rabbit as well. She says, well, what's the significance of the moon and the white rabbit? And I said, well, in Japanese culture, when people look at the moon, instead of a man in the moon, they see a white rabbit pounding mochi in a mortar and pestle. You know what mochi is, everybody? Mochi is sticky rice they make into cake, a little round rice cakes. And I remembered that the story of how the rabbit came to be in the moon was based on an ancient Indian Jataka tale. The Jataka tales, or folk tales, about the Buddha's previous lives before he became the Buddha, when he spent many lifetimes as a bodhisattva. Do people know the word bodhisattva? Some might not. The new folks might not. Bodhisattva means awakening being. And a bodhisattva is a being who kind of foregoes a personal enlightenment to stay in the world and help other beings awaken. And the bodhisattva vows to awaken in order to be able to do that. So we're all kind of apprentice bodhisattvas here. And these stories are kind of like fables, Buddhist fables, or teaching stories. Some are quite charming, some of them are pretty moralistic for our present day taste. And when she asked me this question, I remembered the gist of this story, but I was hazy on the details. So I wanted to look it up. And of course, when I looked it up, I found that the details vary with the telling and the teller, as with all folk tales. So here's the version that I'm going to tell. Long, long ago, the Bodhisattva was born as a hare. In these stories, the Buddha is always referred to as the Bodhisattva. And the hare had three friends, an otter, a jackal, and a monkey. As the story traveled from China, from India into China and Japan, the jackal became a fox. The three friends decided that they would practice generosity on the day of the full moon by giving food to someone who was needy. So the otter swam off down the river to forage for some food, and he came upon a fisherman's camp where 7 fish were laid out to dry, kind of skewered on a stick. He looked around. Nobody was around. He said, "Oh, someone forgot these fish." So he grabbed them in his mouth and ran off and jumped back in the river and swam downriver to his den. The jackal, when he went off foraging, caught an enticing smell coming from a farmer's hut. He peeked into the doorway, and again, no one was there. And there was a stack of fragrant, freshly buttered chapati right beside the fire. So he grabbed them and ran off. 7. Did I say 7? There were 7 fish, 7 chapati. The monkey went immediately to an orchard he knew of. Sure enough, the mangoes were perfectly ripe. He looked around, no one was there. So he climbed into the mango tree and picked the 7 biggest mangoes. Of course, the exact foods procured by these animals varied from story to story and place to place. The otter, the jackal, and the monkey were feeling quite pleased with themselves. But the hare still hadn't found anything but grass. In the meantime, Chakra, the king of the gods, had heard about the animal's plan through his godly omniscience and decided to test them. He disguised himself as an old beggar and made his way toward the clearing where the animals had planned to meet. First he came upon the otter stretched out in the sun by the riverside. "Friend, can you spare some food for an old man?" he asked. "Of course," said the otter. He ducked into his den and came out with 5 of the fish and gave them to the old man. "Here, eat well," he said. "Thank you, sir," said the old man. The otter felt quite virtuous. Next, the old man came to the jackal. "Friend, can you spare a bite to eat for a traveler?" "Certainly, sit right down." The jackal trotted off to the bushes where he had hidden the chapatis and brought back 5 for the old man. "Here, eat well." "Thank you, kind sir." The jackal, too, felt quite virtuous. Next, the old man came to the monkey. "Friend, have you anything for a hungry old man?" "Certainly, wait right here." The monkey climbed into the tree where he'd hidden the mangoes and brought back 5 for the old man. "Here, eat well." "Thank you, kind sir." The jackal, too, felt quite virtuous. Finally, Chakra, disguised as the old man, came to the clearing where the hare was waiting for his friends, who came trailing behind out of curiosity to see what the hare would have to offer. "Friend, I've been traveling for days with hardly anything to eat. I'm weak with hunger. Can you spare me something?" Without hesitation, the hare replied, "Please sit down. I will prepare something for you." And the hare had already gathered a pile of dried grasses and twigs. And then he lit them on fire and said, "I have only my body to give. Please be nourished." And he jumped into the fire. But to the hare's surprise, the flames felt cool, and they did not even singe his fur. He looked at the old man, but in the old man's place stood a resplendent king, king of the gods. "Come out of the fire, little one," said Chakra. "You have offered a brave and selfless gift. I want everyone to remember your example of generosity." And at that, Chakra rose into the sky, all the way to the moon, where he took out his brush and brushed the painting of the rabbit on the full round disk of the moon. On the Chinese version, instead of Chakra, it's 3 Taoist immortals. And they reward the hare. Excuse me. They reward the hare by sending him to live on the moon with the goddess Chang'e, where he helps to prepare the elixir of immortality, hence the mortar and pestle. You know, he's grinding herbs for the elixir of immortality. Now, how that goddess got in the moon is another whole story. And then in Japan, the moon, the rabbit is pounding mochi. Rather more pragmatic. We don't know how that happened. But mochi is used for rice cakes for auspicious occasions. So it probably was fitting in that culture. So coincidentally, to all this, in our Wednesday evening Dharma seminar, we're reading and discussing the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which is a poem by the 19th century Zen master Dongshan, which is in your chant book. We chant it irregularly here, but it's chanted regularly at Zen monasteries. There are many wonderful stories about Dongshan, with dialogues between him and his own teachers and his students and his Dharma brothers. And I was reminded of one that I'd read a few years ago that features a white rabbit. When I read it in what's called the Record of Dongshan, I simply didn't understand it at all. And I kind of forgot about it. But this time, with the help of some commentaries, I've really come to appreciate it. So in this story, Dongshan is on pilgrimage with his frequent traveling companion, Sungmi. Sungmi was a fellow student of Dongshan's, and their teacher, with a teacher named Yunyan. And it seems that they knew each other for decades, and often went traveling through the mountains to visit other Zen temples. And in later years, Dongshan's students would fondly refer to him as Uncle Mi. His name was Sungmi, and they called him Uncle Mi. One gets the impression that he was probably older, even older than Dongshan, but he never became a teacher himself. In the stories, it seems that Sungmi often seems to be the fall guy. He sets up Dongshan for a penetrating insight. And yet, when you take all these stories as a whole, you can't help thinking that it's just part of their playful relationship as longtime Dharma friends. So, because these old stories are often dialogues, it helps to have two voices. So, Michael, will you help me and be Sungmi? And I'll be Dongshan.
Okay.
So Dongshan and Sungmi were going down a mountain path, as they often did, and a white rabbit raced across in front of them.
Wow, that was fast.
How so?
Like a commoner being made a prime minister.
How can a venerable old person like you say something like that?
Well, what would you say, elder brother?
Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty. He calls me an elder brother, but actually he's probably older, I think. But I have seniority as Dongshan. So you see why I didn't get it. It's Okay, so one hint. I've been reading this book about Dongshan and his teachings by Taigen Dan Leighton, who's a scholar and an American Zen teacher. And he says that the word translated as swift or fast can also mean eminent or refined. So this rabbit is not only fast, but noble and impressive in some way. And then I realized that this, what I had missed before, that this case is presented in a collection of koans, or teaching stories, dialogues, called The Book of Serenity, and it has a commentary by Wansong. He says that Sungmi's and Dongshan's comments represent two gates or approaches to awakening, the natural and the cultivated. Okay. So he says, usually we awaken by means of cultivation, entering sagehood from ordinariness. So this is like the commoner becoming the prime minister. This is what Sungmi said. In ancient China, the imperial exam system, by which candidates were chosen for positions in the government, bureaucracy, was a kind of meritocracy, although it was compromised by family influences and bribery and corruption. There were definitely examples of individuals rising from very low ranks to very high positions through this, through hard work and study. So we can see why this analogy was used in this, you know, in Chinese culture for the long, slow path of determined practice leading to awakening. And the second gate to awakening is called the natural. This is the perspective that sees our inherent Buddha nature. Our existence is by nature impermanent and boundlessly connected with all existence, but we forget that. Our clear apprehension of this reality of our true nature is clouded by our human greed, hatred, and delusion, what we're called, the Buddha called the three poisons, that distort our view, of what the self is, the self and the world. So this is Dongshan's analogy when he says, generations of nobility, our birthright of Buddha nature, is temporarily obscured and we fall into poverty. We suffer in so many ways from our sense of lack and separation. And yet we have this inherent, the inherent nobility of Buddha nature, infinite connection. So Wansong's commentary continues, if you're originally enlightened and then cultivate afterwards, you enter ordinariness from sagehood, your inherent sagehood, and then you enter ordinariness because of the vicissitudes of human life that convince us that we need to defend ourselves. He says, drifting destitute in myriad conditions, the basic constitution is still there. This image evokes the lines from one of our other chants, Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen, where he says, like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst, like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor, lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. Those of you who were here for last fall's practice period may remember the story of the prodigal son from the Lotus Sutra. The son, for reasons that are unspecified, leaves home, loses his money, wanders in poverty, while his father searches for him for years. When the father finally finds his son doesn't recognize him. When he sees his father approaching, surrounded by his retinue of servants, he's so ashamed of his condition, he runs away. Doesn't even realize it's his father. Most of us have at some point experienced the power of shame, of being so terrified of being shamed that we hide and do not allow ourselves to be truly seen. And yet somewhere deep inside, we know that that's not true, that all those internalized judging voices telling us, who do you think you are? You know, all those other things the voices tell us are deluded. In some deep place, we know that we are more than what those voices tell us. It can take a long time for us to trust our own nobility and the nobility of others. Like the son in the story, whose father first employed him to shovel out the stables and then gradually gave him more and more responsibility. He had to cultivate and grow into his true nature, his nobility. Or you could say he had to drop away, let go of the habit patterns and beliefs that he'd accumulated in his years of living in poverty before his true nature could be revealed. His father embraced him and gave him his inheritance in the end. It's obviously a rather patriarchal story, and the commoner nobility trope doesn't necessarily work that well for our times. Our cultural myth is that hard work and determination lead to success. So maybe our times aren't so different. And we can get hooked by that myth in our meditation practice. You know, we sit really, really hard for more and more and more and more hours. You know, maybe if I did that for a whole year, I could get enlightened. Yeah. If I go to Japan and practice really hard for a year, maybe I'll get enlightened. And then I wouldn't be afraid anymore. Then life would be easier. We can get hooked, and that's called spiritual materialism. You know, needing to get results from our practice. I grew up in the States, and the myth was, well, if Abraham Lincoln, who was born in a one-room log cabin, could become president, you can too. Well, no woman has yet. And the one who may very well become the first woman president certainly was not born and raised in a hardscrabble log cabin. Our culture still worships wealth and celebrity, if anything, even more than Abraham Lincoln's time. And we still, as a society, resist taking an honest look at inequality. But this story is talking about another kind of nobility and another kind of equality. It's the deep, open-hearted compassion born of seeing that we are not separate from each other and from all beings. It's seeing that my well-being is utterly interdependent with the well-being of Syrian refugees and confused, angry ISIS recruits, with the ecosystems of the boreal forest, which I've never seen, and with the hundreds of laid-off tar sand workers. This nobility, this equality, is not always so easy to embrace, but it's the vow of the bodhisattva to do so. There's a verse that accompanies this koan, this story, in the Book of Serenity that describes the bodhisattva path. It goes like this: matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Notice he says both favor, fame, and disgrace are disturbing. Profoundly trust in yourself. In the real state, you mix tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. Now, I left out some lines in the middle that are full of Chinese historical references that support these analogies. But this verse is talking about our path through the vicissitudes of life, guided by our bodhisattva vows to pay attention, to meet each moment, each person, lowly or lofty, each creature, humble or magnificent, with wisdom, compassion, and equanimity, to mix tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. So who was right? Songmi saying that the white rabbit exemplified the commoner rising to be prime minister through years of hard work, or Dongshan saying it was like a noble person falling temporarily into poverty. I think both of them knew perfectly well that it's not one or the other. I think they were playing with each other. I think they both knew perfectly well that it's a dialectical process, two aspects of the same thing. We can fall from nobility to poverty in an instant of anger and harsh words. And we can awaken to our true nobility with the purity, naturalness, and swiftness of a white hare when we let go of self-clinging and open to just this moment. Just this life as it is, and offer our lives freely, just as we are, like the white rabbit in the old story. When I first learned that my Chinese astrological sign was the rabbit, I was a little disappointed. It'd be a little classier to be a dragon or something. But this little investigation that I've been doing has helped me to be more appreciative of the hare's noble history. The hare was venerated in ancient Europe, too, as the companion of the goddess of the dawn, Istra, who was sometimes depicted with the head of a hare. Istra's hare laid the egg of new life to herald the rebirth of the year in the springtime. As Christianity spread and overlaid the ancient ways, the spring festival dedicated to Istra became Easter. And her hair became, you know who, the Easter Bunny. In another little piece of synchronicity, I encountered this wonderful Old English poem or verse dedicated to the mountain hare. I was listening to an album that I hadn't listened to in a while by Robin Williamson, a British folk singer and bard. He's very bardic, called The Iron Stone. And he recites this poem, The Praises of the Mountain Hare. And the old folk belief was that if you encountered a mountain hare, you would have good luck, but only if you put down anything that you're carrying. So this kind of synchronizes with that we have to let go of our grip on what we're carrying, you know. So here's how it goes. They say, the tongues that wag for good or ill, to see a mountain hare is never fortunate, unless at once you place upon the ground whatever you may be holding in your hand. If you've nothing in your hand, why, there's no more to be said. You must set down on the earth, by your feet, whatever you have in your hand, and speak, virtuously and faithfully, praises of the mountain hare. Delightful long-eared leaper of tussocks, I bless you with the point of my elbow and crack my knuckle bones. For you outrun the gusty wind that shakes the grasses. You are as beautiful with your brown eyes as any king's daughter. Regally you sit among the stones. May you prosper in all your business and leave me to my own. So that would have been in Old English. That's his rendering. And then in my Googling explorations, I also discovered that the old agricultural name for April, for the April full moon, was the hare moon. And the April full moon is coming up. It's going to be this Friday, which also happens to be Earth Day this year. So maybe I'm not late for this talk after all. So may we cultivate our gardens and our practice, and may they be fertile as the mountain hare. And may we offer the gifts of our lives without withholding, like that white rabbit so long ago. So thank you for listening to my spring stories today. Thanks.